bunch of Europeans running it, and he's going to be nominally in charge, he meaning Trump. And then they're going to bring in some Arab and Islamic countries to police the place. This is the idea. This is a non-starter. It's just not going to work. And by the way, just to take this a step further, a number of countries, Pakistan, Indonesia, for example, who have been mentioned as possible countries that would put peacekeeping forces in Gaza, have said they will not go into Gaza until Hamas is disarmed. And Hamas, of course, is not going to disarm. They'd be crazy to disarm because there is no hope of a political endgame for the Palestinians. There's no self-determination here. If Hamas disarmed, they'd leave themselves wide open to the IDF.
Can Netanyahu claim with a straight face? Suppose we could stop right there, and I just fill in the blank. Can he? Anybody can fill in the blank. Can he claim with a straight face that his government is abiding by the Witkoff-Kushner-Trump so-called ceasefire?
Not with a straight face. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Lebanon, if you look at what's happening in Gaza, there's abundant evidence, a superabundant of evidence, that the Israelis are not abiding by the ceasefire. They violated on a consistent basis in Lebanon, and they violated on a consistent basis in Gaza. And what does the United States do in these cases? It stands idly by and allows the Israelis to do whatever they want. We continue to fund them, and we continue to give them equipment and support them diplomatically if they ever get into any trouble.
Just like the Congress of the United States sits idly by and lets the president do whatever he wants, even when he's murdering people on the high seas in the Caribbean Ocean, 1,500 miles from the United States.
That's true. But at least the Congress is beginning to get cold feet. They're beginning to get nervous.
Right.
You don't see any of that in terms of how Trump deals with the Israelis or how Congress deals with the Israelis. And that's basically because, as I've said on numerous occasions, the lobby owns Trump and the lobby owns Congress.
Right, right. I mean, is there any feasible way to stop these killings, these criminal acts on the Caribbean, other than perhaps scaring Congress into thinking its members will not be reelected once the public sees the murders on film?
That's possible. I'd say the likelihood of that happening is in the range of 5 to 10%. I mean, the truth is, if Congress decided to take the bull by the horns and get tough with Trump, I think he'd just ignore them.
Here's Senator Rand Paul, actually earlier today on this. Chris, cut number 10.
We've been doing this for 30 years. When the Coast Guard picks up boats off of Venezuela, which we have done historically, about 1 in 4 of the boats, maybe 1 in 5, don't have drugs. So we make mistakes. Are we willing to execute people with a 20% error rate? This is an insane policy. It's inconsistent. It's not war, and it's not the way we've ever done this. Think about it. If we can blow up a boat in the ocean that is at war with us because of the drugs, what about when they get to Miami and they put it in a truck, and the truck's going from Miami to Orlando? Can you shoot a grenade launcher at the truck? No, we arrest people because sometimes we're wrong. You know, the make and the model of the truck is this, and oh, we made a mistake. That was somebody on vacation. We don't blow up people without first arresting them. And this is the way it's been done on the high seas for 100 years or more. And what we're doing now is just plain wrong.
It's a classic, constitutionally faithful clarion cry for something as simple and basic as due process.
I agree. It's hard to disagree with anything that Senator Paul said. I would also note that I think that it's very important that people pay attention to the rule of law, both domestically and internationally. I mean, we have laws for good reason. And I understand that sometimes countries have to violate the law because it's in their security, it's in their national interest, it makes sense from a security point of view. But you want to minimize the number of times you do that and otherwise follow the law as much as possible. And the same thing is true at the domestic level. And in this country, with regard to our leadership, and I think it was true with the Biden administration as well, paying attention to the law was just not that important. We thought we could do pretty much whatever we wanted to do. And the only difference between the Biden administration and the Trump administration at the international level is that the Biden administration trumpeted the virtues of the international legal system, the rule of law internationally, while in practice they were stomping all over it. The Trump administration, at least, is consistent. They're constantly railing against the rules-based order or international law, while at the same time traipsing all over it.
Well, see if you can figure out what the president meant here, because first he says we will release the second tape, the tape showing the survivors clinging onto chunks of wood for 45 minutes before they were murdered. And then he said, I never said I'd release the tape, and then he said he wasn't sure what he said. Let's see if you can figure it out. What he means, number 11.
Mr. President, you released video of that first boat strike on September 2nd, but not the second video. Will you release video of that strike so that the American people can see for themselves what happened?
I don't know what they have, but whatever they have, we certainly release. No problem.
Mr. President, you said you would have no problem with releasing the full video of that strike on September 2nd off the coast of Venezuela.
Secretary Hegseth now says...
You said that. I didn't say that. This is ABC fake news.
You said that you would have no problem releasing the full bit. Okay, well, Secretary Hegseth... No,
whatever Hegseth wants to do is okay with
me. He now says it's under review. Are you ordering the secretary to release that full video?
Whatever he decides is okay with me.
Are you committed to releasing the full video?
Didn't I just tell you that?
You said that it was
You're
up to Secretary Hegseth.
You're the most obnoxious reporter in the whole place. Let me just tell you, you are an obnoxious, a terrible reporter.
Well, this is really ridiculous coming from the President of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, what can you say at this point?
All right, let's transition. When the Kremlin agreed to disband the Warsaw Pact, why did the United States stay in NATO?
We stayed in NATO because we understood that we served as a pacifier in Europe. At least in the western half of Europe. As long as NATO was intact, that meant the United States was there, and it had its security umbrella over the West Europeans. Now, it's very important to understand that when the Soviets disbanded the Warsaw Pact, they were nevertheless content to leave NATO intact. They were content to allow the United States to remain in Europe, because the Soviets understood that we did act as a pacifier. And this is especially relevant with regard to West Germany, which was in the process of becoming Germany. Because you remember at the end of the Cold War, Germany was reunified. So the German reunification caused worries all across Europe. And people thought that the best way to deal with that potential problem was to keep NATO intact, which meant keep the Americans in Europe. We bought that argument, the Europeans bought that argument, and the Soviets and later the Russians bought that argument. So there's no problem there. Where does the problem come? It comes with NATO expansion.
Right.
You well know, Judge, we told the Soviets that we would not expand NATO, that it would not be expanded eastward. And then the Clinton administration came along and they decided in 1994 that NATO would be expanded. And that is the principal source of the problem today. Had we not expanded NATO, and certainly if we had not expanded NATO or tried to expand NATO into Ukraine, Europe, I believe, would be peaceful today.
Instead, you have argued, this is a great piece, it's at the American Conservative, it probably appears elsewhere. Did you give it as a speech or did you write it as an editorial?
No, I gave it as a speech
okay.
before the European Parliament.
Okay, because I could hear your voice and enjoy, actually rejoice at some of your favorite figures of speech. And you argued so powerfully that Europe's future is bleak. Why do you say that?
Well, it's very bleak for two reasons. One is there's not going to be a happy ending to the Ukraine war. The Russians are going to win an ugly victory. Ukraine is going to be destroyed. And very importantly, relations between Russia on one side and Ukraine and Europe on the other side are going to be poisonous. And they're going to be dangerous because there's always a possibility, given all the flashpoints that exist in Eastern Europe, that a war will break out again. So once the war ends, once the shooting stops and you get some sort of armistice or frozen conflict, the potential for conflict, armed conflict, is still going to be there. And you want to remember you're operating in an environment where there are poisonous relations. The other point, and this is of great importance, is that the United States is pivoting to Asia in a major way. You see this in the new national security strategy that the Trump administration has just put out. We view China as our principal concern, and there's a great deal of emphasis in the administration, and especially with Trump himself, in focusing on East Asia and leaving the Europeans to defend for themselves. So what I'm saying here, Judge, is that if we pivot to East Asia, which I think is likely, the end result is that NATO will definitely collapse, or it certainly will be a shell of its former self. And the end result is that the Europeans will be on their own to provide for their own security. And the Europeans live in fear of that possibility. So I think when you put all these things together, it's a very bleak future for Europe.
So the Sun of London, which is a tabloid, reports just a few minutes ago that a British soldier was killed in Ukraine. Now, Colonel McGregor informs that many British special forces and MI6 have been killed, but none of it's been revealed. This time they revealed it because it happened in some sort of a training accident, and the press was there, and the guy was in uniform. Is this going to affect the Kremlin thinking at all, that a British soldier in uniform was killed in Ukraine?
No, I don't think they're going to care at all, for two reasons. One, I'm sure they already know that there are British soldiers in Ukraine. Not many of them, but some of them. The fact is, the Russians are principally concerned with waging the war on the battlefield, and whether there are 10 British soldiers, 100 British soldiers, or even 1,000 British soldiers just doesn't matter very much. And more importantly, the British are not going to put in 1,000 soldiers. They're not going to directly engage in the fight in any meaningful way. So this just doesn't matter very much.
If you had been a fly on the wall at 10 Downing Street yesterday when Volodymyr Zelensky showed up, was greated by Sir Keir Starmer, President Emmanuel Macron, and Chancellor Merz, what do you think you would have heard? What could they possibly say to him? They can't raise taxes. They can't borrow money. Belgium won't let them steal the money from the Belgian banks. What can they do for him?
Well, unless they can steal that money, those frozen Russian assets from Euroclear, there's hardly anything they can do. Ukraine is certainly doomed if that proves to be the case. So I think what they probably told Zelensky at this point in time is to hold the line, and they would do everything they can to steal that money and make sure that Ukraine gets the $100+ billion that it desperately needs so they can continue the war. I mean, there's no question that the Europeans, much like the Ukrainians, are profoundly committed to keeping this war going. They obviously think that there's some chance that the Russians will collapse before Ukraine collapses, and that we will emerge, we meaning the West, and the Ukrainians will emerge victorious. I think this is tilting at windmills, but it's quite clear that the Europeans seem to believe that.
President Trump, in another one of his rants, we don't have it on tape, apparently said he doesn't like the Europeans, he doesn't trust them, and he's thinking of walking away from Ukraine. Now, he said that before, so I don't know that we can put much credence in it. And we just watched that clip where he said, yeah, released the tape, and 5 hours later denied that he had said it. So these sort of wild, almost ridiculous, at times hilarious interactions with the press the Oval Office, I don't think they can really be fairly used as a window into his thinking.
Well, one way of thinking about what's going on, which ties this discussion of Trump to the previous question about the three European leaders and Zelensky, is that everybody now understands that Ukraine is going to lose. And the question is, who's going to get the blame? Who's going to bear the responsibility for the loss? And one could argue that Trump will not simply walk away from Ukraine, because that will then allow the Ukrainians, and especially the Europeans, to blame him for the collapse of Ukraine. So the smart thing for Trump to do in this story is to say, this is a European responsibility, and I will do everything I can to help the Europeans keep the Ukrainians afloat. So that's the Trump perspective. From the European side of the equation, there, I think they want to fight and fight and fight, fight to the last Ukrainian, so they cannot be accused of having bailed out on Ukraine, and can actually make the argument that it's Trump who's responsible for Ukraine's collapse. So what I'm saying to you here is, I have to believe, given what's happening on the battlefield, that the Europeans, and certainly Donald Trump, understand that Ukraine is doomed, that they're going to lose this war, and there's no way of turning the tide. And therefore, the question is a blame game, or the question is, who gets the blame? You're involved.
Right. And Trump is a master at deflecting blame.
Oh, he's brilliant at that. And the Europeans are very good at that as well. Because you want to understand that this is going to be a catastrophic defeat. This is not a minor defeat. This is not like losing in Afghanistan, right? This is a major war where Europe and the United States, or NATO more generally, was on one side, and the Russians were on the other.
Well, you know who he'll blame it on. He'll blame it on Biden, and Biden does bear a lot of blame, but he does, Trump as well, for arming the Ukrainians before Biden was in office, and for continuing to arm them after he came to office the second time. Here is this statement, a bizarre statement he made, as if that's news, claiming that President Zelensky hasn't even read the so-called 28-point proposal. There's a little bit more in there. We'll let you see it and hear it now. Chris, number six.
What's your next step in Russia-Ukraine talks after last week's negotiations?
So we've been speaking to President Putin, and we've been speaking to Ukrainian leaders, including President Zelensky. And I have to say that I'm a little bit disappointed that President Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal. That was as of a few hours ago. His people love it, but he hasn't. Russia's fine with it. Russia, I guess, would rather have the whole country when you think of it. But Russia is, I believe, fine with it. But I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it. His people love it, but he hasn't read it.
Really crazy. His people don't love it. Russia's not fine with it. How could he know whether or not it's been read? That was, by the way, Sunday evening. I misspoke when I said Saturday.
The Russians don't accept this 28-point plan. The Ukrainian people, and I assume by that he means all of Zelensky's advisors, all the key national security establishment figures in Ukraine, they don't accept this plan for one second.
Right.
Zelensky himself, I can't believe he hasn't read it. I'm sure he has, but he surely knows what's in it if he hasn't read it, and he completely rejects it. This is what he said yesterday when he talked to the press after meeting with the three European leaders. He doesn't accept the deal. Nobody accepts the deal. That's the problem. There's no deal to be had here.
You are listening to Iran Radio, and we are so glad to have you on this part of our schedule. And here are some interesting facts about Islam. Let's listen. Islam is the world's second largest religion, and it is a monotheistic faith with about 1.8 billion followers worldwide, originating in Mecca during the life of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Islam means submission to the will of Allah, and its followers are called Muslims. Muslims believe in one God, Allah, who is the creator of all things and has no partners or equals. The Quran is the holy book of Islam, believed to be the literal word of Allah revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Muslims adhere to the five pillars of Islam: Shahada, or declaration of faith; Salah, or prayer; Zakat, or charity; Saum, or fasting during Ramadan; and Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca. The Islamic year is 11 days shorter than the year used in the Western world. This is because the Western year is based on the orbit of the Earth around the Sun instead of on the phases of the Moon. And we'll listen to continuation of Iran Radio. We'll start off this hour with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have For Humanity, a variety of subjects from the Holy Quran, which predominantly tend to be social issues, are dealt with in this program. And we finish off this hour's program with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sassi. He's a professor.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome. As Benjamin Netanyahu's war on Gaza continues under open and unconditional U.S. political and military protection, its consequences are no longer confined to occupied Palestine. The policies of mass killing and collective punishment are now producing global repercussions, fueling anger, polarization, and insecurity far beyond the region. At the center of these repercussions, Jewish communities around the world are increasingly paying the price for policies that do not represent them. As a dangerous conflagration takes hold between the crimes of Israel's government and Jewish identity itself, much like Muslims were collectively blamed worldwide after the crimes of groups such as ISIS, the recent terrorist attack in Sydney, along with similar incidents elsewhere, raise urgent questions about how Netanyahu's wars have become a catalyst for global violence and about the future or failure of the international community to stop a conflict that's threatening global peace and security. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Zakaria Zainab. First of all, let's introduce the guest. Daniel Jessic is author and researcher who joins us from Barcelona. And we also have William Leon, who is political analyst, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us. Let me start with Daniel in Barcelona. The war in Gaza, can we still classify it as localized? Is it still a localized conflict, or has Netanyahu turned it into a source of global insecurity?
I think the consequences of the genocide that is being committed by the Zionist regime in Gaza, in Palestine, have been felt around the world. Of course, the Israeli regime as such has always necessitated foreign support in terms of weapons, economic, and political infrastructure. So the genocide itself would not have been possible without the staunch support of the United States in particular, and of course NATO, European Union, and other major allies of the Israeli regime. So the oppression of Palestinians has, throughout history, been a very transnational one. If the United States withdrew its weapons support to the Israeli regime today, the apartheid regime would not be able to sustain itself for long. So there has always been a very international investment into the settler colonial advance. At the same time, what we've seen in the last, in particular, 2 years is a global outrage against this ongoing live-streamed genocide, and it is, of course, impossible for anyone around the world to ignore this genocide. I think it has shown political alliances, it has shown the political and ideological and moral stance of governments, of movements, of organizations, of people. So Gaza has revealed a lot of what is wrong with the world currently. So it has, throughout history, but especially in the last 2 years, it has had a global dimension. However, I would argue very differently from what the Israeli regime argues, because if we look at the rhetoric used by the Israeli regime, it is, of course, trying to claim that protest against genocide around the world, including Australia, were allegedly anti-Semitic, which is, of course, a very different question.
Okay, let's move on to Mr. Leon. Thank you so much for your patience. I think, you know, in your opinion, to what extent can the rising hatred and violence that we've seen worldwide be separated from Netanyahu's policies? Because as our previous guest just mentioned, what we're seeing in Palestine has never been limited to it. There have always been international connotation to. So in your opinion, how you know, related is these policies of Netanyahu and the Israeli government and the Israeli regime policies related now to the, you know, the global scene?
I believe counter to what Netanyahu and other Zionists claim, this is not as much related to anti-Semitism as it is related to anti-Zionism. And it is a direct response to the settler colonial atrocities and apartheid that is being committed by the settler colonial government of Israel against the Palestinians. It's the same practice that we saw in the United States as the settler colonialists in the United States attacked the indigenous Native Americans. We saw it in the United States as they interned Japanese Americans during World War II. We can see that with the enslavement of Africans in the United States. We can see how it played itself out in South Africa with the settlers in South Africa attacking black South Africans. This is just another chapter in the same book. And the Zionists in the settler colony state in Israel are intentionally misrepresenting the reality here. They are trying to connect the anti-Zionist response to the so-called anti-Semitic response. If they were to stop their atrocities today, if they were to stop the genocide today, you would see a immediate response in terms of a lack of attack on Jews around the world. That's not what this is about.
Right. Okay, so Mr. Daniel, I would like to build on what, you know, Mr. Leon has just mentioned, which is the fact that the Zionists themselves have created a situation where they deliberately, you know, align themselves with the Jewish faith. And we've seen that for many of the 2 years that the protests against the genocide have been taking place, we've had many Jewish voices speaking up. For average people who may not be able to differentiate between Zionism and Judaism, and they just see the, you know, the what's in front of them, how is the world now supposed to react to this? Because this is not the first time, right? Like you just mentioned, the fact that after after the September 11 attack, Muslims generally were classified, you know, all as terrorists. How do we prevent this from happening? Or is it even possible to prevent this kind of hate towards Jews as the Israelis continue to murder and maim?
Exactly. So this confusion between Zionism, Judaism, and Jewish people, and this entire idea of racializing Jewish people as an ethnicity has been by design part and parcel of Zionism. The early opposition, if we go back into history, the early Jewish opposition to Zionism from approximately more than 100 years ago, many Jews have argued back then that Zionism was in fact an anti-Semitic movement because it was based on prominent European white supremacist racial theories and pseudoscience. And interestingly, Theodor Herzl, one of the so-called founding fathers of Zionism in the late 19th century, has in fact predicted that the anti-Semites would be the closest allies of the Zionists. So Zionism is a racist movement, and it has been using Judaism for its purpose by trying to hide behind the idea of dominant concepts of understandings of Judaism, Jewish culture, and so on, in order, of course, to conflate what Zionism, again, just to repeat for viewers, Zionism is a genocidal settler colonial movement that is a racist ideology, and it has emerged in the last 200 years or so. It is, however, culturally and politically a very dominant and powerful force in the Western world and in the settler colonies, including North America, Australia, and so on. And of course, this conflation has been by design for Zionists because Zionism requires a hatred towards Jews. It requires this idea that Jews would not, that Jews are different, that they wouldn't feel safe elsewhere. So there's a lot to unpack here, but right. Basically we're talking about equating a genocidal movement with human beings.
Right. Mr. Leon, I want to come to you and I want to address this as an African-American yourself who have experienced the fact that generalization when it comes to population or race is very dangerous. Even though we understand why people are angry at the Zionist regime because of the brutality that they have unleashed on the world, how can we stop or react or perhaps address the fact that people now are generalizing and saying, yeah, well, they deserve it, they got it coming. And because we know the danger that that entails, because if we allow it for one group, then we're saying that it is okay for every other group.
What transpired in Australia was a hate crime and is unacceptable. Anyone with a moral compass should be disgusted at what transpired in Australia. That was a horrific act that cannot be defended in any way, shape, or form. But with that being said, it's important, I think, to differentiate between the heinous act that took place and the politics behind it. So when you, and this is one reason why I don't have a problem having this conversation, because Benjamin Netanyahu chose to politicize the atrocity. The Western media has chosen to politicize the atrocity. So I'm not, nor do I think anybody on this, in this discussion, Daniel or anybody else, is justifying or rationalizing what happened. It's an atrocity. But as soon as the interests in the Zionist colony decide that this fits their political purpose, well, now then that to me opens up an entirely different conversation.
Right.
When commentators in the West start discussing this in the context of anti-Semitism,
right,
they're wrong. And we need to, not all Jews are Zionists, and not all Zionists are Jews.
Okay, very important points there. I want to go back to Daniel, building up on what Mr. Leon has said about the fact Western media is playing on this because, and they're trying to use it to propel the narrative that has been prevalent for the past 7 decades when it comes to the issue of Palestine or when it comes to Muslims in the region. But I do want to point to the fact that one of the incidents that has sparked a lot of online reaction was the fact that a Muslim man or someone who is seen as, you know, from West Asia was one of the people who stopped this, and it's either been glazed over or it's been ignored. And if it'd been reversed, if he had been the one perpetrating that act, the Western media will be very fast to point to his faith. Can you speak on that, please?
Definitely. And there's, of course, again, here a lot of different problems that play a role in the Western media's very racist framing when it comes to the representation of anything related to Palestine and to the Zionist entity in general, which of course has to do with the very well documented and academically documented in research bias of dominant Western media, and of course the political economy of major Western media outlets, where oftentimes crucial details are omitted, particular details are focused on in order to create certain frames and biases that would help perpetuate dominant narratives. One example that we've seen is that some Western mainstream media was very quick to try to ridiculously blame Iran even for the incident that has taken place in Australia. So Western dominant media is generally, I'm speaking about mainstream media such as the New York Times in the United States or the BBC and other state media in Europe, very much aligned with the Israeli regime. And so, of course, a story in which a Muslim individual helps save people's lives and prevent more atrocities is not as favorable as speculations or racialized depictions of or speculations about perpetrators. And this is something that we've seen again throughout the past decades, because one major component of Western media is, in particular in the last 2 years, to perpetuate this genocide, to normalize the genocide and to justify it without naming it. So even when it comes to any representation that has anything to do with, in this case, if we're referring to the statements by the Israeli regime, there is oftentimes the Israeli regime's line becomes part of a headline. And is the main source, and this is a structural problem in Western media. So what we've seen in the last 2 days is not surprising at all, unfortunately.
Right. I want to go back to Mr. Leon.
Can I add one more example?
Yes, 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 go ahead.
I think Daniel would agree with this. When you look at the gentleman, Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, the Afghani who shot the two National Guard people in the United States, the Trump administration immediately tried to spin this to be anti-immigrant. And they also spent a lot of time talking about how was this man radicalized and who radicalized him and we don't know who he is and all of this, only to find out that he was part of the Zero Unit in Afghanistan. He worked for the CIA. He was trained by the CIA, and the issue with him was not the fact that he had been radicalized. It was the fact that he had been ignored. Once he was brought to the United States failed to support him. And when he couldn't support his family, he then had a mental breakdown. So they didn't want to discuss that aspect of it because it didn't fit their anti-immigrant narrative. So again, they politicize the tragedy and try to spin it to their own advantage.
Right, and staying with you, because we know that you're trying to spin this as well. You're trying to make different aspects of it to fit into that narrative. And one of it is what Daniel mentioned with the fact that Iran is being named as one of the suspects. And I just want to point to perhaps how desperate now the Asbara and this, you know, propaganda narrative is getting to the point where countries like Iran, that itself has been repeatedly attacked and targets of terrorist attack, will now be named without any evidence, without any facts, and this is also being repeated in many Western media. Can you please speak on that?
Well, Iran is an easy target, no pun intended.
Right.
Iran is an easy target because Iran has been vilified to such a degree by the West that now all Netanyahu or all Donald Trump or any of the others have to do is mention the name. And mentioning the name, mentioning the word, the country Iran, creates this knee-jerk negative reaction, again, because of the vilification that they have been subjected to. And we find this usually what the United States does is they vilify the individual. So whether it's President Putin is a madman or whether it's Maduro is a madman, they tend to personalize their vilification.
Right.
But in this instance, as it relates to Iran, they have vilified the entire country.
Okay. Mr. Daniel, I want to look at the fact that, terrorist organization or terrorist groups such as ISIS do not need justification. But going forward, they might be exploiting the images coming out of Gaza, just like we know that they exploited, the images coming out of Iraq when the U.S., attacks that country to recruit and carry out more terrorist attacks. And we know that, some are saying that this attack in Australia is linked to the terrorist group. In your opinion, do you think we might be seeing a repetition of this where terrorist organization takes something out of context and use that to justify their own heinous attacks?
Well, this might be very possible, but I think the underlying problem at this point is really to identify who is or constitutes which so-called terrorist organization, given in particular what we've seen in the last 15 years or so in Western Asia, obviously given the a lot of the information that was made public or was leaked by official communication of the U.S. government. We know that there has been a collusion between terrorist groups in Syria and Iraq with the U.S. government and the CIA and the Israeli regime. We now have a situation in Syria where some of those terrorist groups are now the internationally recognized government of that sovereign country. I think the boundaries here have been blurred to some extent. You all mentioned Iran, how Iran has been and continues to be a target of terrorism of ISIS and the Israeli regime, but it is being presented itself as a terrorist organization in Western political discourse. So it very much comes down to the question who talks on behalf of whom, who actually has the power to write these narratives. But I definitely think that political, different forms of political violence, which are widespread, might be, of course, expanded. We need to keep in mind that there is, on the other hand, of course, globally, frustration in different regions for different reasons going on. So I think that obviously violence continues to take place, but it's always a matter of how it is being framed and presented.
Okay. And also I want to go to Mr. Leon, because we know that the United States and in extension the Western Hemisphere has continued to support the Israeli regime to carry out many of its crimes, not just in Palestine, but also in West Asia, attack across many countries. Do you think now that they also have a responsibility in the way that, the world is reacting to Israeli crimes? Because we have discussed how globalized the Israeli crimes are. It's not just limited to Gaza. Jews now across the world are paying the price for it. But do you think perhaps we may say that the United States, and in extent, Australia and many of the other Western countries that have continued to support the regime are also in fact responsible for the violence that we may be witnessing in the near future?
Oh, there's no question. If this were in American criminal law, they would be accessories before, during, and after the fact. Because the genocide that the Zionist colony is engaged in could not take place without support of and funding and armament from the United States. And when you look at the attacks on Israel, when you look at what's taking place in Lebanon, these things could not take what's going on in Syria, as the Zionist colony has played a role in undermining the stability in what was the stability in Syria. All of this cannot take place without the United States agreeing to allow it to happen. Right. So yes, they are definitely complicit, and they are accessories before, during, and after the fact.
Okay, Mr. Janel, just before we let you go under a minute, if you can, we do know that before the genocide in Gaza began, Netanyahu himself was under a lot of public dissatisfaction, and we saw thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Israeli coming out against him and demanding for his arrest. We may argue on what basis they were coming out, but the very prevalent information is that he is not very welcomed in Israel, in Israeli politics. But we see that the media doesn't really, recognize this aspect of things. And even if it does, it is only to justify and say, oh, it's only a fringe part of Israeli, society that wants to genocide in Gaza to continue. Look at all these people protesting. But it's something different. I do want to ask, though, that, why is voices that are against Netanyahu, even within the Israeli system itself, being ignored by the Western government? Why do they continue to fund and support this genocidal, war criminal, according to the International Criminal Court?
Because the Israeli regime serves as a military base and as an extension of Western white supremacy, racism, and colonialism in Western Asia. The Israeli regime is a tool for the West, for the United States, and so, of course, it is very important for Western media and political discourse to present these all Israelis as one collective unit that is defending itself allegedly and under threat. And of course, the other reason is that Zionism is a genocidal movement. Netanyahu is a symptom of the broader issue. If it weren't for Netanyahu, there would be someone else in power who would be administering this genocide. So these are only minor differences. In the end, the issue, the genocidal structure, lies in the movement itself.
Okay, well, we would have enjoyed to keep this conversation going, but we are out of time. So let me thank both of you for taking your time to join us, first in Barcelona, Daniel Yujik, author and researcher, and also from Washington, D.C., Wilmer Leon. Both of you, thank you so much for your time and your contribution. Thank you so much. Goodbye from me and the team.
Muscle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about Islamic teachings and Quranic concepts. pertaining to humanity and mankind. And in the previous episodes, we started covering a very good book in this topic, which is titled A 250-Year-Old Person, which is a compilation of the lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei about the life stories and the seerah and the biographies of the great leaders of Islam, starting from the Prophet of Islam, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, which continues to the life of the great leaders of Islamic community from the pure progeny of the Prophet. By analyzing the lives of these personalities, we get to know more about the Islamic ideals, about humanity and mankind, especially when it comes to the socio-political aspects. So we covered the life of the Prophet of Islam. We arrived at towards the end of his life when he made the pilgrimage to Mecca for the last time, Hajjatul Wada. And there the Prophet delivered two sermons which are very decisive, that are called the Sermons of Mina. And in these two sermons, the pervasive tone and concept in those sermons are the socio-political aspects of the Islamic Ummah. And we covered those aspects. And we also talked about how these two sermons could be understood as the context for the incident of Ghadir, because these are three most important occasions that all Muslims are there to receive the somehow the final message, the final public message of the Prophet. And it makes sense because the Prophet of Islam, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, had developed and have erected a very tall building, Islamic community, and which continue to and continues to exist to this day. And it is only rational and logical that a person who has done so much in this regard, with all of those efforts and difficulties that he went through, and he started it from zero or even below zero, and obviously this was by the help and support of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala throughout the whole process, and still the support of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is with the Islamic Ummah. But the efforts of the Prophet should not be overlooked. Anyways, so this is only logical and rational that a person who has made such great effort do not or does not just leave it without any will, any advice, any guidance about what is going to happen after me and what would be your source of reference to. So these are very important topics that are covered in these three occasions, two sermons of Mina and one sermon at the incident of Ghadir. Ayatollah Khamenei says that the incident of Ghadir, it has two dimensions. One dimension that Shia celebrated more than any other groups in Islamic Ummah, and that makes sense, although it should not be like that, because Ghadir belongs to everyone, because Ghadir is the assignment or appointment of the next successor of the Prophet. However, throughout history it has been so, and some other Muslim sects, especially with the rise of Salafis, they have chosen to dismiss or not to celebrate Ghadir. That's another discussion. But then there's a dimension of Ghadir that belongs to all Muslims, regardless of the political nature of Ghadir, and we're gonna cover that after the short break in the next segment. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. الزهراء والحسن الرحيم Welcome back. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the incident of Ghadir and how there are two aspects of the incident of Ghadir. One is the political aspect, which unfortunately has been overlooked by other Muslim sects, and there is a more comprehensive and general aspect of the incident of Ghadir that all Muslim, the whole Muslim Ummah should pay attention to. And that is that what is the least level of the message that was conveyed in the Ghadir? And that was the fact that the Prophet wanted all Muslim community to renew their relationship with Amir al-Mu'mineen and to know him as the Wali. Okay, this is something that we all can agree on. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason. Even if we take, okay, we say, okay, let's assume we do not want to talk about the political successorship, okay? But then, what's the meaning, what's the wisdom behind this, that the Prophet wanted everyone within the Muslim Ummah to know this? Some people, unfortunately, they try to say this was some misunderstanding, misconception among several people. Like there was a circle of people around the Prophet, they had some misunderstanding about the Amir al-Mu'mineen, and then the Prophet wanted to tell them, no, this is not true. Okay, if the Prophet wanted to tell them and to inform them or to clear off those misunderstandings, he did not need to stop all Muslims, and he did not need to make a public